I mean, that's the thing about retreat, is that it gives you a chance to relax, because there's nothing else to do much. You can go up to the stupa and come back, and that's about it, right? Eat. Retreats like that. Solitary retreats like that. It's very interesting because in solitary retreat, you find out how much you want to keep doing things all the time. You know? Because like there's actually absolutely nothing to do. You know, when you're all just by yourself in a cabin or something like that. And then you come in with all kinds of instructions. The lamas are very clever because they give you like all kinds of things to do. You know, you do this and set up this and this altar and then do this many mantras and do this and all like that. But really, you don't have to. It's just you in there. Nobody's going to like, you know, kind of bust in and say, have you done your mantras yet? You know, so you realize like how much of an obsession that we have of doing things all the time, of keeping busy all the time. And there are many, many texts that say, including the Ashtavaka Gita, which is a great, great text from the Advaita Vedanta tradition, that samsara, the cycle of suffering, is nothing other than the feeling that we have to keep doing something all the time. And that's a very profound, actually, the feeling that we have to do something all the time instead of just be content, just stay still, not doing anything. So anyway, we all have a chance, even in a group retreat, to learn how to not do anything. If you don't want to come to these classes, that's fine. Okay, nobody's going to come knocking on your door and saying you're absent, you know, or take some grade away from you, or you know, like nothing. So you're free, and you know you can find out for yourself how much resistance there is to being free. You know, to have complete freedom is something we actually abhor. So samsara is always having something that needs to be done. Kartavya in Sanskrit. Kartavya. Must be done. Should be done. And that's why we suffer. We suffer because we're not content. We suffer because we always think that something needs to be different or fixed or improved or at least, you know, something, you know, to keep us busy, occupied. Even when there's no purpose to it, we still need to be occupied. So this is the second class of the four-part class on the chapter 8 of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life on the perfection of meditation, jhana. I think maybe best to translate in this context jhana as a meditative attitude or a meditative lifestyle or a meditative, state of mind. Because it's not, as we mentioned last night, it's not really talking about the technique of meditation, you know, of how to sit and how to put your body and, you know, how to get yourself into meditation and so forth. I think more or less assumes that kind of thing. And besides, that's not really the purpose of meditation, isn't to get really good at meditation. The purpose of meditation is to get good at living. So meditation, like anything else, can be an attachment. You can get attached to it. And, you know, people who are longtime meditators know this, I think. That is, you know, you get fairly good at it, and it's very pleasant, actually. It's very, very pleasant. You know, nobody's bothering you. You know, even your own mind is under some kind of control, more or less under control, so it's not like completely, you know, yabbering in there all the time. And, you know, it's very pleasant. And then you think, wow, this is nice. Maybe this is the point, is to just stay here. Forever, somehow. And that's not the point. The point is to learn how to live, how to get up off the cushion and learn how to integrate with the world around you, with reality, not to escape reality. That's a big mistake, I think, when it comes to understanding of meditation. It's not to escape reality. It's not even to get a little less stress for a few minutes and then go back into your life and stress out some more. You know? I mean, this is often how meditation is integrated now into the workplace and into the schools and stuff like that, is to, you know, give people a little downtime so that they're more efficient when they come out. You know, and are like, you know, can really crank out those, you know, products or whatever. So that's not the point. The point is to learn how to live. So the guide in chapter 8 really is talking about how to live a meditative lifestyle. And what to meditate on, which is the other crucial thing. I mean, you know, it's good to meditate on your breath. Breath meditation is very, very relatively easy kind of meditation, and it does relax you. Anyone can do that. I mean, that's a very good thing to relax, actually. You sit and watch your breath for a while. That's fine. Or, you know, put your mind on a statue, you know, one-pointed meditation on some statue or something like that. But, you know, how about putting your mind on something that will totally change your sort of sense of self? And that's what he's talking about in this chapter. How to re-envision who you think you are. And so today in this class, we'll get kind of, you know, into the depths of it. We're going to finish the eighth chapter by tonight. Four classes, right? So it's quick. It's down and dirty version. I mean, we go through every verse and stuff like that, but it goes very quick, and by the end of tonight, it's all over. And then tomorrow, you can, you know, prepare. Get a lot of sleep tonight. Maybe take some Benzedrine or something like that in the morning. So that you'll be, you know, ready for a very difficult set of teachings. These are relatively easy, you know. It's like just how to be kind of nice. We'll see in the second class today, the afternoon class, that the technique that Shantideva recommends for, you know, for meditating on the object that he's going to present is actually kind of tricky. Exchanging self for others. Equalizing self for others is the first part of the technique, equalizing. And that, we'll cover that in today's class. But then the exchanging part is a little tricky, because he's going to ask you to be someone else. And it's kind of hard to be someone else, right? Because we think we are who we are. Like Popeye or something, I am who I am, and that's all that I am. You know? But you're just a construct. The you that you think you are is just a construct. It's just an idea. And ideas can change. If there was a real you, you know, somewhere down in there somewhere, a little, you know, kind of like mini-me, like in the Mike Myers movies, there's me and there's mini-me and mini-me's in here somewhere, I don't know where. If there was a real you in there, then you couldn't exchange self for those. Be impossible, because you are who you are, but you're not who you are. You're hardwired, you see? You're fluid. Your sense of identity is fluid and changes all the time, by the way. Changes kind of moment by moment. I mean, we have this sort of sense of continuity of our identity, but actually, if you like analyze it, you know, constantly changing, constantly undergoing change. Every time you interact with anything, with any other object, you change something a little bit, right? Because you don't exist without an object. The subject does not exist without an object, and the object does not exist without the subject. Okay? That's interdependence kind of at its deepest level. There's no you without another, and there's no another without you. Okay? And that's how it is. So every time you interact with someone else, both things change in a way, you could say. Change one, you change them both. So anyway, let's get going, shall we? Just a quick review of where we've been so far. We did 88 verses last night, and I went through them pretty quickly because you got the point, right? Yeah, a lot of stuff on renunciation. A lot, you know, pretty hardcore. Shantideva, like I was saying last night, is he doesn't mince words. He's very direct and very confrontational sometimes, like kind of in your face a little bit. And you'll see other verses like that in the next couple of classes. But the main point he's trying to make is that if we are going to really increase bodhicitta, he's assuming now by chapter 8 that we have some version of bodhicitta, of a mind that's awakening to the fact of interdependence, the fact that we are not alone. The fact that we are not independent individuals. He's assuming that some version of that has you know, kind of arisen after seven chapters. So, you know, by eighth chapter, actually in seventh, the beginning in the seventh chapter on virya, on enthusiasm, he's talking about methods to kind of expand that sense, that sensibility of belonging to a larger whole. Okay? Thich Nhat Hanh said that, once said that we were put here in this life to overcome the illusion of separation. The illusion that we are separate from other beings and the world around us. It is an illusion. We couldn't exist. We don't exist that way. Nothing exists that way. Nothing exists independently. Everything exists interdependently. And also, by the way, it doesn't exist dependently. That's a misunderstanding, mistranslation into English. Because something that depends on something else presumes that the something else is there first. Right? So, you know, if I depend on you to be me, that means you have to be there before I'm there. Right? And that's not the case. There's no you without me, and there's no me without you. Neither can exist without the other, and... mantra, that's your mantra. And neither can exist first. And that, you know, like I keep saying, you know, that's the key. If you wanted to really, like, sit around and think about something for a long, long time that would be useful, instead of, like, what somebody, you know, said to you at breakfast, you know, you could think about the implications of that phrase. One thing can't exist without the other. Neither can exist without the other. The subject can't exist without the object. The object can't exist without the subject. The visual object can't exist without the seer of the visual object. And the seer can't exist without the visual object that the seer is seeing. And neither can come first. And neither can come first. Five-word mantra. Neither can come first. And if you think about that long enough, you understand them quite clearly. How it is that they, you know, many of these texts say that the world only has a dream-like existence. Only a dream-like existence. Because in a dream, it's not that way either. In a dream, it's not sequential, kind of. You know? Everything's just kind of like happening, you know? In some holistic framework or something like that. All right, so anyway, the class last night was really on the prerequisite to having a meditative mindset that truly understands interconnection, especially interconnection with other beings. And that requires a kind of a stepping back, a detachment from the attachments that we have to worldly things, to the world of sensual pleasures, to the world of sense objects, and so forth. Like I said last night, in the yoga system, they call this I forgot it now. It's the withdrawal of the senses. Pratyahara. Withdrawing the senses. In order for what? What, you know, in the yoga system, what comes next after pratyahara? The meditation. Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi. So first, in order to have the possibility, opening the mind to the possibility of having any kind of shamatha, peace of mind, meditatively, you know, acquired peace of mind, first there has to be this kind of detachment. Detachment from all the things that are the stimuli, the stimulus that's bombarding us all the time and that we are attached to. So, remember the verse 4 that we covered in the last night, in the 8th chapter, verse 4, that vipassana, which I translated as insight, but it really, what vipassana kind of means is analytical wisdom. Analytical wisdom. So it's wisdom with concept. Conceptual wisdom, which is not the only kind of wisdom, it's not even the highest kind of wisdom. But it's certainly an important kind of wisdom. The ability to discriminate properly, to understand how things are, you know, conceptually, to understand intellectually how things are. That depends on shamatha. That depends on getting the mind calm enough so that you can really understand things without that internal noise, with the yabbering inside, the little voice inside. Everyone got one of those? That's driving you crazy, by the way. Okay, that voice inside is the problem. Okay, that is the problem. That you could also say that is samsara. Samsara is the internal voice that keeps you at a distance from reality. It mediates you from reality. It keeps you at arm's length from what's actually happening. Because what's going on inside is you talking about what's happening. You conceptualizing about what's happening. You kind of categorizing. This is good. This is bad. I like this. I like that. Nice thing that she said. Bad thing that she said. You know, always talking, always categorizing. So Vipassana is learning how to categorize properly, you could say. And in order to have Vipassana, you have to have the shamatha that's like shuts that voice down, you know. It's shut up in there already. And in order to have shamatha, in order to have peace of mind, there has to be this kind of renunciation and detachment. So 88 verses on all the things that we should detach from. And most importantly, and he comes back to this regularly in the text, most importantly, detachment from the body. Your body and other bodies, both. I mean, last night it was a lot about other bodies. But detachment from your body, especially. We are not just our bodies. Okay? This is what distinguishes a spiritual worldview from a materialistic worldview. The materialistic worldview that we're all quite acquainted with, actually, because it is the scientific worldview, fundamentally. That the only thing that exists is what can be measured, what can be quantified. Okay? And however, even in some realms of the, you know, of the scientific worldview, like, for example, physics, or even neurobiology, there's some understanding that there's something that can't be captured. You see, in neurobiology, I think they call it the ghost in the machine. There's the machine, you know, and the brain is a machine. But there's something else in there that you can't quite put your finger on, right? There's a spirit. And that's what makes a spiritual kind of method spiritual, is the idea there's something that transcends the merely physical. You are not your body. You are not just your body. You're not your body. And that's a very hard thing for us to kind of really grasp, because we're so attached. We're so attached to our body. We think we are our bodies. And we suffer. That is one of the main reasons why, number one, why we suffer, and number two, why we don't get it, that we are interconnected. Because attachment to the body increases our sense of separation from other bodies. If we are our body, then we're not other people. Because they're their bodies, we're our bodies, and our bodies are not the same, obviously, right? So the interconnection doesn't come physically. The interconnection comes spiritually. The interconnection has to be realized at a spiritual level, not at a physical level. So anyway, that's enough review. We're at verse 89, and we only have 40 to do today. So pretty easy day so far. Having envisioned the benefits of solitude. So that's the previous 88 verses, really, of how important it is to get solitude, both physical and mental. Okay, you know, Shantideva's emphasis tended to be on the physical solitude, and that's important also. It's important to be alone. It's important to get yourself into situations, you know, with some regularity where, you know, you withdraw from the world. You know, have your own little space somewhere where you can put your body alone and learn how to be happy alone and not always be in connection, always have to feel like, you know, that you're in some kind of, conversation with other people all the time. But most importantly, mental solitude. Which, is a little more subtle, obviously. But it means finding some kind of mental space where you can relax. Some mental space where you can feel, you know, the beauties of being, you know, kind of disengaged. And this is also, of course, temporary, you know. As is any retreat. You know, any retreat, any meditation session, any, you know, kind of finding this kind of solitude, mental and physical, is a means to an end. It isn't the end. The end is to learn how to integrate with others, okay, with the world itself. But in order to do that, we got to get some breathing space. Mm-hmm. We got to take some, you know, deep breaths, and then come back. Come back, you know, with a different kind of attitude. So prerequisite is this solitude thing, but, you know, as we'll see even in today's class, it is only a prerequisite. It isn't the end. The end is to learn how to come back into the world with a very different conception of who you are vis-a-vis the world. Having envisioned the benefits of solitude with these and other images, with one's intellectual disputations, vitarka. Vitarka has been used again earlier in this same chapter. The constant argument, especially spiritual, philosophical, religious argumentation, has got to be put to rest. You know, I mean, again, I think some people get so, especially like eggheads, you know, intellectually inclined people get so into this you know, kind of philosophical argumentation that they lose sight of the fact that that too is at best a means to an end and at worst the problem. Okay? I mean, you know, this is the history of warfare. The history of religious warfare is about, you know, disputes about, well, you know, is God this, is God that, you know, is there an Atman, is there a non-Atman, you know. A wonderful text at the end of the Ashtavakra Gita, I think it's 20th chapter, I think it's 20 chapters. And it says, this is a text about a liberated person, what a liberated person would look like. And the whole chapter is like, what do I care what you guys say? What do I care if you say there's an Atman or an un-Atman? What do I care? That means no matter. From the liberated point of view, this is all just, you know, chit-chat. You know? Sometimes armed and dangerous chit-chat. But it's just, you know, babbling. It's like a swimming pool. All the noise is coming from the shallow end. And at the deep end, it's quiet. Everyone shut up already. Because everyone, in the deep end, people know that it's just words. It's all just words. It's not the reality. Reality and words are different. Like we were saying last night. You know, we are both imprisoned by and made ignorant of reality because of language. Because of our reliance on language and concept. Conceptual thought has its place. But there also has to be a detachment from that too, ultimately, if you're going to hear the truth, if you're going to realize the truth. The truth is not capturable in words, ultimately. The ultimate truth is not conceptual, you see. Our conceptual framework imprisons us in our conceptual framework instead of within, you know, leading us to reality itself. So intellectual disputations put to rest. He should arouse the wish to awaken. Bodhicitta. Bodhicitta. So now we're moving towards how to do it, you know. The whole text I was saying yesterday, the whole text you could say is about bodhicitta. And so, you know, the chapter 8 is included in some systems. As increasing bodhicitta, but it can also be read as arousing bodhicitta, as how to generate bodhicitta. And those of you who have studied the Lam Rim, the steps on the path, may recall where equalizing and exchanging self, which is what chapter 8 really is about, equalizing yourself with others and then learning how to exchange yourself for others, where that falls in the Lam Rim. Who remembers? Yeah. All these teachings are categorized in one place or another when it comes to the Lam Rim. Lam Rim's the overarching system where you can put everything, you know, find everything. Where is it in the Lam Rim? It's going to be in the step shared with greater scope, that's for sure, Mahayana, okay? But where? Exchanging self, equalizing and exchanging self for others is a method for generating bodhicitta. There's two camps here. There's two categories on how to generate bodhicitta. One is the seven-step mother meditation, which many of you have learned. And the other category is, and all the other methods for doing the same thing. All the other methods, which includes equalizing and exchanging self for others, as well as the four immeasurables, which we'll be doing, talking about on Sunday afternoon, actually. Both of those are methods, both are different, slightly different methods, for achieving the same goal as the seven-step mother meditation. For those of you who don't know, I won't go through the seven steps, but it just means, like, you know, thinking about every being as if they were your mother, and in order to generate that same sense of connection with all of the beings. So this chapter is also going to give us some practical meditative advice on how to get over ourselves, how to transcend ourselves, the individual self, and feel this sense of belonging, this sense of identity, even, with other beings, okay? So, arousing the wish to awaken. At first, so part one of how to do this method, one should be devoted to the realization of equality, of the equality. Samatha, sama. Sama is related to the English word same. Samatha. So samatha is sort of like literally translated into English as sameness. Sameness. So at first one should be devoted to the realization. So it's not like imagining something that isn't true. It's recognizing, realizing the sameness of oneself and others. All are the same. And then he says, how, okay? Because there's, you know, it doesn't, what do you mean all, everyone's the same? Everyone's different, isn't it? Everyone's got a different personality. Everyone's got different, you know, professions. Everyone's got different family life. Everyone's got different language that they speak at home. Everyone's got, you know, different race. Everyone's so many differences, aren't there? The differences are minor compared to the great equality. Dalai Lama likes to talk about this as the great equality, the great democracy. He comes to, you know, democratic countries and he says, oh, very good, democratic, you know. But the real democracy is in this verse here. All are the same in their suffering and their wish for happiness and are to be cherished just like I cherish myself. Everyone is equal in that everyone does not want to suffer. There is no one who wants to suffer. Even people who, like, pretend that they want to suffer don't really want to suffer. I mean, there are some people who kind of, like, get into it. You know, they wear black all the time and never go outside and, you know, smoke French cigarettes and, you know, write poetry, you know, kind of bleak poetry, you know. And, you know. But they're just trying to be happy, too. They're just trying to be happy through like, being depressed. No one wants to suffer. And that's not just the case with human beings. No living thing wants to suffer. It's, you know, it's the law of nature, actually. It's a law of nature that no living being wants to suffer. And, conversely, every living being wants happiness, wants peace of mind, wants, you know, to live a pleasant life. And everyone is exactly equal in that. And no one's right to it is any more important than anyone else's. Okay? It is a right. It is a universal right not to suffer. And a universal right to be happy, to live a pleasant life. And no one's claim to that right is more important than anyone else's. The great democracy. Okay? And so we all think, no. I mean, you know, theoretically. But, you know, somehow my wanting to not suffer and my wanting to be happy, you know, is sort of more important. Because why exactly? And the only answer to that question, why we all individually think that our need to avoid suffering and our need to maximize our happiness is more important than others, is because it's ours. That's the only reason, okay? There's no other reason. It's like four-year-old logic. Why is your desire to be happy and avoid suffering more important? Well, because mine. It's mine, not yours. Mine. You see? And so, you know, the great democracy. If we're, you know, if everyone has this as a right, and you say, how many people besides me feel that they have the right to be happy and avoid suffering, a lot of hands go up. Mine maybe doesn't, but a lot of others do. And then when they say, and how many think that Marut's right to be happy and avoid suffering is more important than everyone else's, one hand goes up. You know, in a democratic system, in an election, I would lose, kind of like overwhelmingly, landslide. A landslide defeat for Marut when it comes to Marut's thinking that his, you know, right to, you know, avoid suffering and be happy is more important than anyone else's. So it's that way with everyone. So this is the great equality. This is the great samatha, sameness of all living beings. Just as the body with its many components, divisible into the hands and so on, is to be cherished as a whole. So your body's got hands, it's got arms, got elbows, got legs, got a torso. All the different parts of the body are all parts of the body, right? They're component parts of a larger whole. I think, isn't there a phrase like this in English? The corporate the body, corporate body, and the social body, and like that. You see, so it's just, it's like a human body. Just as the body with its many components, divisible into the hands and so on, is to be cherished as a whole, so too is humankind divisible. You're not saying that there aren't, you know, different people in the world. And yet the same as myself in its suffering and its wish for happiness. All the parts are part of a larger whole. I'm just a small part of a larger whole. And every part of the larger whole has exactly the same rights as every other part. Although my own suffering is not experienced in the body. So now he goes into this thing, well, why should I identify with other people? And he gives like two different reasons why we resist this idea. Although my suffering is not experienced in the bodies of others. So, you know, when I have a, you know, a sore foot, you know, Angie doesn't limp around. So what do you mean where, you know, I should like identify with all other beings? You know, she didn't identify with my sore foot. How come she's not limping around? I got a sore foot. She, Angie's not limping. Although my own suffering is not experienced in the bodies of others, it's only difficult to bear because of my attachment to myself. So, you know, this chapter, chapter 8, is right before chapter 9, coincidentally. 9 follows 8, actually. And he's kind of in, you know, as we go through this material on equalizing and exchanging self for others, is giving us a preview of chapter 9 on emptiness. So already here he's saying that, you know, the problem is that you're grasping to the self. You're grasping to an imaginary self. I have a sore foot. Well, who's the I that has the sore foot? So, well, you know, me. And, you know, chapter 9, beginning tomorrow, we'll find out all the reasons why there is no I like that. That I is an illusion, just an illusion. So we're grasping onto something that isn't even there, called the self. And then we're saying, I have a sore foot. Angie's not limping around. I have the sore foot. Well, who's the I? And then he goes for the other direction. Likewise, although another's suffering is not directly experienced by myself, so I imagine that there are other people in the room who have physical or mental suffering now too, but I don't feel it. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like, you know, maybe someone just lost a loved one or has some big problem at work or some physical ailment. I'm not sitting there like, you know, suffering as a result of it. So why should I, what do you mean identify with others? Why should I? Likewise, although another's suffering is not directly experienced by myself, it is difficult to bear because of that person's attachment to their self. So the suffering that others have is because of their attachment to the illusory self that they think they have. The suffering that I think I have is because of the attachment to the illusory self that I think I have. All suffering comes from attachment to self. All suffering comes to the attachment to the individual, independent, separate self, which is just an idea. Okay? Just an idea. It isn't something real. When you go looking for what you who you think you are, it is unfindable. Unfindable. You get the Where's Wally book here in Singapore and other places? Yeah? Where's Wally? Where you look for that guy with the beanie and all like that. So when you go looking for Wally, you go looking for yourself. You can't find it. You can't find it anywhere in there. We'll do some heavy-duty proofs of that, you know, beginning tomorrow probably. I should eliminate others' suffering. Why? I should identify, equalize myself with others, and work to eliminate suffering. Why? Because it's suffering. It's not somebody's suffering. See? It's not somebody's suffering. It's not my suffering, not your suffering. It is suffering. It is suffering without an owner of suffering, as they'll say later in this text. It's sort of free-floating suffering. And suffering's not good. So, I should eliminate other suffering. Why? Because it's suffering. It's as simple as that. I mean, you know. And then we get all entangled. Yeah, but it's not mine. It's just somebody else's and all like that. Well, there is no me and there is no you that suffer. The me and you that we think we are is an illusion. But their suffering is not an illusion in a way, right? It functions very well, right? Brings us unhappiness. And so unhappiness, no matter what body it's found in, is wrong and should be eliminated. Okay? No matter where it happens to be located, it should be eliminated. Just like my own suffering. Just like I want my own suffering to end, other people's suffering. They also want suffering to end. And the separation between me and others is illusory. And I should support others because they are living beings, just as I'm a living being. The great democracy again. All living beings are the same. Despite their superficial differences, the great democracy is that all living beings equally want to be happy and avoid pain. And I'm a living being, and all other living beings are just like me. There's a phrase from ancient Roman times, Terence. He said, I am human. Nothing human is foreign to me. I am human. I'm a living being. So nothing that happens with living beings is ununderstandable to me. Because we're all living beings. And one of the things that happens with living beings is they suffer. So just as I suffer, I can understand that other people are suffering just like that. And suffering as a whole should be eliminated. Not just my suffering. Or not the suffering, just the suffering of people I like, or my family, or my loved ones. All living beings have the right. When I and others equally, tulya is in Sanskrit. Tulya comes from a word related to the scales. Like if you went to a market and got some rice and they put the scale on to measure how much rice you got. So it's balanced. When I and others are balanced equally, of the same value. When I and others equally value happiness, what's so special about me and my own struggle to achieve it? So why do I think I'm unique or special or set aside? Everyone's the same. When I and others equally do not want fear and suffering. See, throws in fear here. It's kind of interesting. You could argue that among the greatest things that we suffer from is fear. Fear of what would happen. Fear of what is going to happen. Right? Fear of the future, actually. Because, when it actually happens, you're not usually not afraid. You just have to deal, right? When something like sickness happens, well, then you're sick and then you have to, deal with it. But then we all feel, well, maybe I'll get sick. When you lose your money, well, you figure out what to do next. But thinking about losing your money causes great stress and anxiety. When I and others equally do not want fear and suffering, what's so special about me that I defend myself and not others from them? What's so special? Vishesha means what's different? What's the particular difference that I think I have from other beings. See, what's so special? If the reason that I think I'm special, if the reason that I do not protect others is because their suffering does not plague me, so we're kind of back to the same thing. Well, you know, their suffering doesn't affect me. Then why protect one's future body from suffering that does not plague me now? So now he kind of moves into a different direction of argumentation. We do a lot to protect our future bodies, don't we? Kind of watch what we eat and take vitamins and do our yoga and, you know, exercise and, you know, go to the doctor when we get a little cold so it doesn't turn into pneumonia later, right? But then he says in the next verse, if we say, well, you know, that will be me. The body that I will have later is, you know, in some way connected to the body that I have now. That's me, and I am connected, and I'm identified with the body. If we say I will be the same, it will be the same I then. So it's not the same. It's not to say the reason he's going this way is to say, look, we don't identify with other bodies. We don't identify with other people because we don't think we're them. So he's saying, well, look, what about your future body? Will that be you? He said, well, of course. It will be the same I then. And he says, you thought about that wrongly. You didn't get it. You don't understand. The one who dies is different than the one who's born. Again, he's talking very specifically about the physical body. Much of this is about the physical body because we're so attached to it. So let's just, you know, stop and check. If you are your body and therefore separate from other bodies, you know, identifying with the physical body separates us from other bodies. It precludes the idea of really identifying with other beings because we have different bodies. So if you are the body, are you the same as you were when you were 3 years old? In any way whatsoever, you see? Are your cellular structure the same? They say you get a new cellular structure every 7 years. Every 7 years, your body completely changes. People who are older in this room, myself included, know this very well. That, you know, you get, your body undergoes huge changes over the course of a lifetime, right? I mean, unrecognizable changes. My eldest daughter sent me a picture a while ago of when she's now like over 40, when she was about 4 years old. So I don't know what that would make me, young and younger. And I couldn't even recognize me. I couldn't recognize myself in the photo. It looked like a different person altogether. You get old enough, you'll find this, okay? There are people in this room who know. If they look back on their photos from when they were like, you know, teenagers or early, you know, adults, what the hell's that? I look pretty good. So if you are your body, then how can you be same? How can you be the same? Even over one lifetime, you know? He's not talking about many, many lifetimes and reincarnation and all of that. Even in one lifetime, if we identify with our body, then how can we be the same person as we go through time? If we have identified with our body, you see? By the way, I wanted to say, like, you know, we got a lot of verses. There's going to be a whole session for questions. And I think maybe Angie or somebody has put somewhere a basket or will soon. And, yeah, and maybe you could just write down your questions and put it there. All right, so if you say it will be the same I then, so we protect our future bodies. We take all kinds of measures to try to make sure that our future physicality will be, you know, fine, will be healthy, will be, you know, like, right? So he says, if you're thinking that, then you just don't understand, because the physical body undergoes changes. Of course, over long periods of time, obvious changes over long periods of time, but even moment to moment, everything physical is going through change, including your body. You see? So we protect a future body that is going to be different from the body that we have now. So why not protect other bodies that are different from the body that you have now? Why not care for them? No difference. If there is the thought that the one who suffers should protect only him or herself, then why does the hand protect the foot from suffering when it's not the hand suffering? So he comes back to this idea of the composite body made up of different parts. And when, you know, when you step on a thorn, the hand goes and tries to get the thorn out. The hand comes to the rescue. The hand's not hurt. The foot's hurt, right? But the hand somehow like identifies with the foot. The hand regards the foot as part of itself and similarizes it. So too can we learn to think about other beings as part of ourselves, just like the hand thinks of the foot like that. If this proceeds from the ego, ahamkara, ahamkara is a very interesting word in Sanskrit. Aham means I, and kara means maker. So the ahamkara is the I maker. The imaginary machinery that makes up an I, ahamkara. If this proceeds from the ego and is therefore unbefitting, one should with all one's might reject what is unbefitting in relation to oneself and others. So, you know, he's kind of like pausing to mention, like, it's just egoism. It's egoism that's the cause of not thinking of the equality of self and others. And so, you know, get rid of it. Then he kind of gives us a little bit of a preview again of chapter 9. A continuum and a collection are false. They are like an army regiment. So this obviously needs some unpacking. I'll get back to it. Since there is really no one who is suffering, to whom will that belong? To whom will suffering belong if there's no one who suffers? So then back to the first part. We think of ourselves as a self because of continuity over time, a continuum, and because of a collection of parts. So the continuum over time is what we call a lifespan, right? A lifespan. So I am because I have a lifespan. I have some continuity over time, which is an illusion. There is no continuity over time. It's the continuity is overlaid as an idea over time. Everything is changing. Everything physical is changing, and everything mentally is changing all the time. That's one sort of understanding as to why a continuum, a lifespan, is illusory. Because it's only an overlay, an idea overlaid on a process, constantly changing process. Physical process. What about mental? Do things mentally change? We've established that physically you're changing all the time. What about mentally? You change all the time? People sometimes ask me about rebirth, especially in Western countries where there isn't the kind of assumption of rebirth that there is in Asian countries. And so, like, you know, what's the proof of that? No, there's no real proof of it, actually. It's just kind of anecdotal evidence, and, you know, at best. But you get to a certain age and you look back at your life. How many different lives have you led? I mean, almost completely different lives, you know? Different body, different kind of attitude, you know, different worldview, different, like, outlook, different people around you, you know? So I have no problem in believing in rebirth. I've had 7 or 8, even in this lifetime, you see. So the continuum, the grasping to self based on a continuum is the grasping to an illusion. The continuum is just an idea of something that continues. That's one level. I mean, another level is continuums are impossible, actually. You know, continuum means a linkage between one moment and the other, right? So where's the linkage between the end of moment A and the beginning of moment B? Where's the linkage? If there was a linkage, there wouldn't be moment A and moment B. Okay? Because they'd be the same moment. If they were actually touching somehow, they wouldn't be different. Okay? And if they're truly separate, then how can they be linked at all? How can the end be linked to the beginning of the next moment? They're two different moments, you see, two completely different moments. All right, so then the collection part. So it can't be a continuum, so what about the collection? This is why he uses the army regiment here. I looked it up. A regiment is a military unit made up of two or more battalions. And a battalion is a unit made up of two or more companies. And I don't know if it goes down further than that, but that's, you get the point? These are just names for a collection of parts. A battalion, there's no battalion. It's an idea that links together different, what did I say?
Regiment.
A regiment is an idea that links together two or more battalions, okay? And then the battalion is just an idea that links two or more companies. And down you go, actually, probably. A company is just an idea that links however many people have to make up a company. And down you go. See, it's just so when we think about ourselves as a collection, we think of ourselves as a collection of physical parts and mental parts, right? Physical parts, all the parts of the body, and all the parts of the mind. The memories that we have, the ability to discriminate, the consciousness that we have, it's all these different parts of our mind and body, and then we overlay on top of that a label and say, me. But these are just, the me is just a name. It's just a concept. It's just a category. It isn't something. It's just an idea of something. And by the way, that's all the way down. There's no part that can't be divisible into further parts. Okay? So the body is made up of lots of parts. Let's see the body, right? Body is made up of lots of parts, like a hand. Does the hand have parts? Yeah, the hand's got the palm and the fingers and all like that. So what about the finger? Finger's part of the hand, hand's part of the body. What about the finger? Does the finger have parts?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got this part and that knuckle part and this part and that joint part. What about this top joint part? Does it have parts?
Yeah.
What about the fingernail part of the top joint part? Does it have parts?
Yeah.
There's no part that can't be further divisible into its parts, because if there was an indivisible part, you ready? Indivisible means can't further divide it. If there was an indivisible part, it couldn't have a right side or a left side or a top side or a bottom side. In other words, it would be everything, indistinguishable from anything else. Okay? So every part must have further parts. So we think that we are, somebody, an eye on the basis of a collection of parts, but the collection of parts are at every level further divisible, at every level. So, you can do that until you get tired, and then you finally say, well, there's nothing there. I think the physicists have done this, kind of. They got tired. And trying to find an indivisible part of matter is impossible, you see. I think they get, I don't know that much about physics. JJ probably can help me. But I think they've gotten to the point where they say at a certain point, you can say that it is indeterminate whether it's physical or just energy. You can understand it either way. It's all process?
Yeah.
So back to the next part of that verse. Since there is really no one who is suffering, since the self is unfindable, who does suffering belong to? All suffering occurs without an owner. Aswamika. Ah means not, swami, swami, ka. There's no owner to suffering. It is non-differentiated and is to be averted. Why? Simply because it's suffering. Not because someone suffers, but because it is suffering, you see? Not because I suffer or because there's someone else who suffers, because there is no I or someone else, but because it's suffering. And so it should be eliminated. Why set limits on this? Why say, no, just me? Why should suffering be averted? No. Well, why then? Why should suffering be averted? Well, he says everyone agrees on this. There's no one who says suffering shouldn't be averted. There's no one who's arguing like we're for the suffering. We're pro-suffering. There's plenty of people, I suppose, that argue for the suffering of other people. They're pro-suffering of other people. But if there are no other people, if there are no you or me, if the owner, there's no owner of suffering, then everyone's agreed that suffering's bad. Because this is the great democracy. All beings want to be happy and avoid pain. Why should suffering be? Everyone agrees on this. It's not controversial. There's no one who doesn't think that suffering should be averted. So if it is to be averted, then it should be averted in all cases. Then no one has some kind of special claim to having their suffering be removed and other people's suffering not be removed. Not just when it comes to myself, but for all living beings. Argument. I've put this in quotations, and I'll come back to this this principle when we get to chapter 9, because Shantideva sometimes lapses in, kind of obviously sometimes, and not so obviously other times, to objections. To objections to his own point of view. And you don't know when he's doing it sometimes. I mean, sometimes they say iti. Iti means like, oh, you can put quotation marks around it. But in this case and many others, he doesn't use iti. So you just have to like kind of figure out, and there's lots of kind of, you know, different opinions about when he's talking as an opponent and when he's talking as himself. Here it's pretty clear he's talking as an opponent. If much suffering comes due to compassion, kirpa, which is very much the same word as karuna, which you guys all probably know, many of you anyway. If much suffering comes due to compassion, why require the cultivation of it? Why should I cultivate compassion? It's just going to cause more suffering. You just said, Shantideva, you just said that suffering's bad, okay? Suffering's bad no matter where. So what about this compassion thing? Isn't that just going to increase suffering? If I have compassion means that you have passion, you have, you know, suffering, come together with someone else, right? You link your passion, your sensibility to other beings. So won't that bring more suffering to me? And the answer is, of course, yes, actually. Yes. If you identify yourself more widely than just yourself, then not only do you have your what we call our own suffering to deal with, you have the suffering of all other beings to deal with. So what does he say about that? When one becomes aware of the suffering of the world, how can the suffering that comes with compassion be regarded as very much? Compared to all the other kinds of suffering that there are, the suffering of hunger, the suffering of sickness, the suffering of death, the suffering that, you know, billions of people undergo. A little bit of suffering that comes from compassion is nothing. You see what I mean? If the suffering of one eliminates the suffering of many, then one should instigate that suffering out of kindness for both oneself and for others. So here he's talking about sort of sacrificial suffering. You sacrifice your own happiness, your own, like, egotistical, individual happiness to take on the suffering of other beings in a kind of a sacrificial way. You give up your ego for the greater whole. And he says, and that brings both happiness, more happiness to the others, because you're working for the elimination of their suffering, and it brings more happiness to yourself. And that's a little tricky. Why would it bring more happiness to yourself? Because you're not there anymore. You've lost the sense of individual ego, grasping to the self, grasping to the individual ego. And that automatically brings more happiness to you. Check me out, okay? Check it out. When are you actually happiest in life? And it is when you are lose yourself, when you can lose yourself in something else, that is happiness, actually. That's the definition, really, of happiness. Joy, ecstasy, ecstasis, standing outside. Outside of what? Outside of the individual ego. Standing outside. You get outside of yourself. And that's bliss. So he's saying, like, you identify with other beings, you'll automatically feel better. Why? Because you won't be you anymore. You won't have the pain that comes from grasping to the self. This is why, I'll read this verse, but I don't understand it. This is why Supushpa Chandra even knowing of the king's anguish, nevertheless did not eradicate his own suffering as a sacrifice for the suffering of many. This is a reference, apparently, to one of the many, many stories of the Buddha when he was a bodhisattva. Here, as this person, Supushpa Chandra, and, you know, he did something awesome then, and so just like that, you should do that too. No, I looked for it. I couldn't find it. Couldn't find it, like, what exactly the reference was. And so it is that those who continuously display the same love for others who are suffering plunge into the lowest hell like swans diving into a lotus pond. This is now he's full-on bodhisattva, okay? 100% bodhisattvas, willing to go even into the hell realms, you know, to help other beings, like a swan diving into a lotus pond. They become oceans of joy when living beings are liberated. So their joy comes from the liberation of other beings, because they've identified with other beings. So when other beings are liberated, they feel great, because they are other living beings, and are fulfilled by that. What use do they have in bland liberation? Moksha. Moksha means freedom or liberation. Arasika. Rasa. Rasa. What does rasa mean? Taste. Arasa means there's no taste to it. No flavor. No savor. So arasika means the moksha arasika here is individual nirvana. Solitary nirvana. Which is regarded as dry, you know, tasteless, as compared to the universal nirvana that a bodhisattva is seeking, because they've identified with all other beings, not just with themselves. Craving single-mindedly for the welfare of others, para-artha, not just sva-artha, para-artha. Artha means interest, welfare, material gain, you know, advantage. So, working for the welfare of others, they work for the sake of others without conceit or arrogance. Na mada na vismaya. So this is a very important verse here. And with no desire for future karmic reward. So, he's talking about a bodhisattva, full-on bodhisattva, who's identified with all of the beings, working for all of the beings, trying to liberate them, trying to prevent their suffering, and so forth. But without pride, without conceit, without the idea that I am a bodhisattva, saving all of you suffering beings. See? That is not a bodhisattva. If you think that or say that, it's definite proof that you're not a bodhisattva. You say, I am a bodhisattva, saving all suffering beings. Definite proof that you're not at all a bodhisattva. You're a pretender. You're a fake. And with no desire for future karmic rewards. Vipaka pala. Vipaka means fruition. Pala means the fruit that's ripened. Vipaka pala, the fruit of action. Akancha. Akancha means desire or hope or expectation. A means not. Having no hope, no expectation of any future karmic rewards. Okay? And that's very important, okay? Very important. That is the true bodhisattva way of life. Not for what you're going to get out of it. Without any self-interest involved at all. All karma is involved in selfishness. All action that's done karmically is done selfishly. That's what makes it karma, okay? Karma ultimately comes from intention, sankalpa. What is your sankalpa? And you know, you can have relatively good intention or relatively bad intention. Relatively selfless intention or relatively selfish intention. But if there's intention, there's an intender. Okay? There's a self that has the intention. An individual self that has an intention. And therefore, there will be fruit. There will be results. More or less good, more or less bad, but there always will be karmic results if the karma is done, if the action is done with intention. Always results. So, karma is not the solution. Karma is the problem. This is not controversial, okay? There is no Indian-based religion, Hinduism, Buddhism, yoga tradition, that says anything other than karma is the problem. And you can't karmicize your way into enlightenment. You can't karmicize your way into moksha or liberation. So we have to ultimately figure out how to transcend karma. You know, not to not act somehow. All, you can't do that. Bhagavad Gita is quite clear on that. But how to act without karmic repercussions. How to act freely. How to act without intention. Because it kind of comes down to that. So there's lots of different sort of ways of thinking about this. You know, in this text, the solution to karma is to be a bodhisattva. Bodhisattvas do not create karma. Bodhisattvas do not act with conceit or arrogance and with no desire for future karmic rewards for themselves, because they aren't themselves. You see? They're not individuals anymore. A bodhisattva is working as all sentient beings, not for all sentient beings, but as all living beings. So a radical re-identification, a radical sense of who is the actor. If the actor is regarded as an individual self, there will always be karma and there will always be bondage. There will always be the bondage of having a consequence that must be reaped because of an action, either good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant. Always keeps you involved in bondage. Okay? So this is a very, this is the unique Mahayana Buddhist solution to the problem of karma. Is to re-identify yourself as all sentient beings. And then there's no karma. Then it's just merit, you see. There's a difference between karma and punya. Punya. Punya means merit. Buddhas and bodhisattvas are constantly generating merit. But that's not karma, because it's not attached to an individual. It's not produced by an individual, and it's not reaped by an individual. Radical. You get this? It's very important, okay? This is how to under... This is the key, really, to Mahayana Buddhism, actually. The key, the thing that makes Mahayana Buddhism Mahayana is bodhicitta. Is the wish to achieve awakening as all sentient beings. Not for all sentient beings, but as all sentient beings. So this one, this verse 109, you know, is refrigerator magnet worthy. A bodhisattva is craving, you know, interesting, you know, choice of language here, you know, craving, really wanting, trishnaya, trishna, you know, really craving. Craving what? Craving is supposed to be the problem in Buddhism, right? Here it's like reconfigured as the solution. Craving single-mindedly for the welfare of others. So single-mindedly for the welfare of others means not at all for yourself. Not at all for yourself. Craving single-mindedly for the world, they work for the sake of others without pride, without conceit, without arrogance, without any kind of like ego involved, and especially without any expectation of getting ahead somehow karmically as a result of this. Therefore, just as I protect myself from condemnation, so too will I bring about a mind of protection and compassion when it comes to others. Just as I defend myself, I'll defend all beings. From, you know, here he's talking about condemnation. So it's only due to habit, abhyasa. Abhyasa is a word found often in yoga texts, right? Yoga Sutra especially. Abhyasa means practice, repetition, discipline, you could even say. Habit. It's only due to habit that one says, I exist, on the basis of some drops of blood and semen that comes from others. This is an ancient Indian understanding of conception. The seed and some drops of blood and, you know, presto changeo, there's you. It's only due to habit that says that's me. You know, you're really talking again about the body, right? You're talking about the physical body. Only due to habit do you identify with the body. That comes from other things anyway, right? It's not even yours. It was produced by somebody else's seed and somebody else's egg. Although the thing in question really doesn't exist at all, asatya, it's not even there, the I. Knowing that one's own faults, why not regard the bodies which belong to others as myself, since the otherness of my own body is not hard to establish? That's kind of important too. The paratva, otherness of your own body. You can understand that pretty well. We went through, you know, about an hour about on the otherness of your own body. That it's not you. You see? So why not regard the bodies that belong to others as yourself, since your own body isn't even yourself, you see? Knowing one's own faults and the sea of good qualities that others have, one should contemplate renouncing one's own existence, separate individual existence, and adopt that of others. You know, it's a good trade. Other beings, when all other sentient beings, you know, cumulatively, have a lot of good qualities to them. You know, there's like a lot of talents. There's a lot of like, you know, amazing moral people, a lot of really good meditators. So, you know, you win if you say, I'm them. Now I'm a good meditator. Now I got all kinds of talents and so forth. You see? It's a good trade-off. Just as the hands and so on goes back to the body again. Just as the hands and so on are valued as integral parts of the body, why shouldn't also the embodied beings, which are the integral parts of the world, why shouldn't also the embodied beings, which are all part of the thing, just like hands, just like feet, we're all part of the larger whole, the body. Just as the belief in a self in one's own body arises due to habit, abhyasa again, the only reason we think of ourselves like we do is because we got used to thinking ourselves of ourselves like we do. That's the only reason we do it. Okay? And so he's saying, you can change your habit. Because the self is only an idea of the self, you can change your idea of the self and radically expand it. Just as the belief in a self in one's own body arises due to habit, even though there is no self in it, why can't the identification of the self with others arise due to habituation? And so it is that when working for the sake of others, he repeats this almost word by word. He repeats verse 109 here in verse 116. So it must be important. You know, Shantideva probably had editors who said, like, hey, wait, you already said that once. And says, yeah, no, I'm saying it again. And so it is that when working for the sake of others, there is no conceit or arrogance, no big, Superman T-shirt like Gary's got on, so, Bodhisattva Superman, you know. I am a Bodhisattva. So when working for the sake of others, no conceit or arrogance, even while enjoying oneself, bojayatva, you know, boja means enjoyment. So even while having a good time, no expectation of future karmic rewards arises. No hope, no expectation. He comes back to expectation quite a bit, actually, in this chapter. Expectations are disappointments in training. If we have expectations, you know, for the future, I did this, so I should get that. You are setting yourself up for sadness, for disappointment, over and over and over again. How often do your expectations actually come true in exactly the way you thought they were going to come true? See? So it's not the point to have expectation. The point is to be happy here and now. So that's kind of, I think, one of the reasons why he's saying this, even while enjoying oneself. While being happy doing, carrying out bodhisattva activity with no pride, no arrogance and so forth, and with no expectation for the future. That's what makes it possible to really enjoy it now. You see? If we have futuristic expectations, we never really fully enjoy what's happening in the here and now. Never really focused on it. Just as you want to protect yourself from pain, grief, etc., so too should a mind of protection and compassion be cultivated for others. Then another one that I don't understand. The protector Avalokita, that's Avalokiteshvara, elevated his own name to remove people's fear of speaking in public. I guess he gave some boon or something like that. To, you know, if you have some fear of public speaking, you can say his name and then that fear will be removed. I'm just guessing. One should not run away from doing what is difficult. Dushkara. One should not run away from a difficult task, which is identifying with all other beings. That's a difficult task. It's difficult to overcome the ego. It's difficult to overcome this strong sense that we, grasping to ourselves and cherishing ourselves. Very difficult, but one should not run away from the power of practice. Abhyasa again. Abhyasa shakti. The shakti, the power of abhyasa, of practice, is such that even something one has heard about and fears is not without its pleasures. So he's talking about, you know, fear. Again, fear is a fear of what could happen. So even something that you heard about, that, oh my God, what if that happened to me? You look forward to it. Great. Because it's just another challenge. It's just another way of overcoming your sense of self, overcoming your sense of propriety over the imaginary self. Whoever wishes to... So, and by the way, like, any time we suffer, you can always trace it back to the grasping to the ego. Always. That is the root of all suffering. Grasping and cherishing, they say. Grasping to the self, grasping to the imaginary self, and then cherishing it, loving it to death. And every form of suffering comes back to that. Every form of suffering. So one should not run away. Power practice is such that even something one has heard about and fears is not without its pleasures. Whoever wishes to swiftly protect both himself and others should practice this supreme secret. All right, we're moving to part two now. Part one, equalizing self and others, regarding everyone samatha, as the same, and getting very, very clear on it, which is the precondition for part two. Okay? So they come. This meditation comes in two parts. This is the object of meditation in the chapter 8. He's not talking about all the other things that you could meditate on. He's talking about a particular kind of meditation, which is very interesting. This is a great classic of Mahayana Buddhism and of world spirituality. Of all the different things one could meditate on, this is the one he's picked. The whole text is on how to generate bodhicitta, how to live like a bodhisattva, bodhicharya avatara. So if you're going to live like a bodhisattva, here's maybe the best thing to meditate on. Number one, think of yourself and others as exactly the same. Exactly the same. Identify with all of the beings, you know, as all equals. And then here's part two, which he calls here paramam guhyam. Guhyam, the great secret, the highest secret. You know, it's a... So why? Because, you know, many people would, if they heard this, they'd just say, what bullshit is this? The next thing that comes, which is exchange yourself for others. Okay? Not just think of yourself as equal to others. Be others. Exchange yourself for them. So whoever wishes to swiftly protect both himself and others should practice this supreme secret, the exchange, parivartana. Parivartana means inverting, causing to turn around. Inverting yourself and others, which means being them. And he's, in the next class, later on this afternoon, he gives you three ways to do this. And it's tricky, and we'll do it together. But it probably will take more than one go-around to actually do it properly. So it's a practice. So abhyasa, learning how to practice. So this is a big takeaway from this retreat, actually, is the method of how to exchange self from others. Another good, and as a prerequisite to make sure you understand those verses on the sameness of self and others. Because otherwise it doesn't work. If you don't think that you are exchangeable, if other beings are exchangeable with you, then you can't exchange yourself with others. So the sameness means that you are exchangeable, interchangeable parts. When even there is a small threat, fear arises because of the overweening attachment to the self. All fear comes from attachment to the self. Why should one not hate to sell. How did I translate this, Cindy? She told me not to translate it like this.
Yeah, I said you shouldn't say you should hate yourself.
So how did I translate it there?
I think you still have that, didn't you? Why should you not be hostile to yourself?
Is that what I said?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a little bit less in your face than hate yourself. Now the verb is dvishet. Dvishet comes from the same word as dvesha. Dvesha means hatred. So it means this kind of hostility or hatred of oneself. Of the ego, really. He's talking about the ego. Not your true self. You should never hate your true self, because your true self is the only self you really got. Your Buddha nature. You know, your perfected self. When there is even a small threat, fear arises because of the overweening attachment. Why should not one hate oneself as one would a deadly and formidable enemy? All fear comes from grasping to and cherishing the self. One who kills... So he's talking about, well, what does one do as a result of grasping to the self? And so here gives a little laundry list. One who kills birds, fish, and beasts, and is their adversary because of the desire to prevent sickness, hunger, and thirst, for the individual self, for the ego, who would even kill his parents and steal from the three jewels for profit and honor, and would become fuel in the lowest hell. What learned person would desire, protect, and revere a self like that? That's the ego. Who would not see it as an enemy? Who would esteem it? Then a very famous verse, refrigerator magnet worthy. If I give it, what will I have to consume? If I give things away, you know, like right up into and including my very self. If I give it, what will I have to enjoy? What will I have to consume? This is the selfish thinking of demons, of the pishashas. If I consume it, if I use it up for myself, what will I have to give for others? This is the way of the altruistic thinking of the gods. I think probably you all have heard that verse before. Yeah, very famous verse. Hurting others, did I translate it that way?
Oppressing others.
Oppressing others while serving. Go ahead and read it, Cindy. I don't know what I changed.
Oppressing others while serving one's own interest. One cooks in the hell realms. Oppressing oneself while in the service of the interest of others. One succeeds in everything.
Yeah. The desire for self-aggrandizement, for unati means elevating or advancing the self. The desire for self-aggrandizement brings about a lower rebirth, a bad reputation, and stupidity. So here he's talking about actually the karmic result, the karmic causes of grasping to the self and cherishing the self and just like thinking about yourself all the time. A lower rebirth. So what goes up must come down. It's a karmic principle, actually. You know, you've heard what goes around comes around, but what comes up must go down is also a karmic principle. So if you take pride in your birth, the circumstances of your life, that, you know, maybe in some sense or another comes from karma, but it's not your karma. You say your name to yourself. It's like someone else's karma, like in your past lives, you know? Like, what is one of the things about karma is that, you know, if we sort of buy into the whole idea of karma over lifetimes, one of the reasons why we can't remember past karma is because we weren't ourselves then. You know, we weren't the personality that we are in this life. There was some continuity or something, but it's not you in the sense of you say your name to yourself, and you won't be reborn, also, you, JJ, or, you know, Angie, or, you know, anyone here won't be reborn. You'll be someone else. And you won't say, oh, I used to be JJ, and now I'm, you know, Sam. Right? So there is this kind of transition, this movement of karma, but not personalized, not individualized. Yeah, it's the self, the little self, the illusory self. That will disappear entirely. So where was I? Oh, yeah. So the lower rebirth. Taking pride in your present circumstances. The family you were born in, the, you know, culture you were born in, and so forth. The opportunities that you had were given in this life. Taking pride in that results in a lower rebirth. So, right? The desire for self-aggrandizement brings about a lowering, pride in your circumstances, a bad reputation, taking pride in your social standing. I'm an educated person. You know, I'm a learned person. I'm a economically superior person, something like that. What goes up must come down. A bad reputation. Taking pride in your social standing results in having other people revile you as a, you know, as a lower class person. And then stupidity. If you take pride in your intelligence, what goes up must come down. And you, the karmic consequence of that is that you'll be reborn stupid. Taking pride in your intelligence is already stupid. So, a little bit sort of forewarning. Bossing another around for one's own advantage, one comes to experience the state of slavery. Again, the karma correlations here. Thinking that you're so superior to others and bossing them around comes back at you as being the slave of other people. Bossing oneself around for the advantage of others, one comes to experience the state of master, such. The last shall be first and the first shall be last, Jesus said, right? Which is also a karmic principle. It's also a karmic principle. So, made it. Made it on time even, 1:14. And we got introduced in this segment to equalizing self for others and just the beginning of the idea of exchanging self for others. So the next class we go into very deeply on the methods for exchanging self for others, which is actually quite a controversial method, as you'll see, because you're going to be using mental afflictions as a meditative tool. Yeah. You're going to be using pride, envy, and competitiveness as a meditative tool. And this doesn't get taught that often, actually, for kind of obvious reasons. Because, you know, like the usual standard issues, you know, pride's bad, don't be proud. You know, envy's bad, don't be envious. Competitiveness, not good. Rivalry, not good. But here they're saying, use those mental afflictions and jujitsu them. Jujitsu them. So you're using a mental affliction against yourself. And we'll see how this works, okay? The exercise for class two is to, as you'll see in your reading here, is to spend some time reviewing and contemplating the arguments in the text on why it's illogical to believe that your right to happiness is more important than anyone else's right. And your desire to not suffer is any more important than anyone else's desire. To think about all the reasons for that. You know, we have to convince ourselves of these things intellectually. We have to intellectually, kind of really think, you know, that, yeah, that makes sense before it's going to seep down any lower than that, deeper than that. If it doesn't get past the brain, it's not going to get to the heart. So you got to like convince yourself, and that's the beauty of a text like this is the logic of it actually, you know, he's very logical, very very logical, and it's hard to argue against it. Yeah, so spend some time with that. All right, let's take a break. When do we meet again?
Five.
Five, not until five? Okay. So, see you then.